Well, good to see you guys tonight. Always fun to come back and share the word. Good to be back, actually. Had a good trip, though. Robbie and I had a fun vacation. That was a blast. If you will turn to Genesis chapter 16, we're going to continue on with our study in the book of Genesis tonight. Just to kind of give you a background so that you can remember since it's been a while, we're dealing here, we're still following the story of Abram, how God is unfolding His plan for the ages through this particular family, through this man initially and his wife, and then it will lead to a nation which will deliver to the world a Messiah. So remember last time that we looked at this, Abram had a encounter with God as God cut a covenant with him, remember? And he stayed out there in the evening. He'd taken those animals, cut them in two. He had the vision of the fire, smoking pot and the fire that came through. Smoking pot. The smoking cauldron or whatever. That's how he had that dream, huh? I think it says a smoking fire pot, doesn't it? I think that's where I got mixed up. But anyway, the point of it is that he had this covenant with the Lord, and it was a cool deal. So we go on from there. One of the things that was transpiring in that last chapter, remember, Abram was complaining to the Lord. The reason they even instigated this covenant is in chapter 15, Abram was complaining to the Lord, saying, "What am I going to get out of this whole thing? You know, what am I doing out here? I don't have any son, and I think it's going to end up being my servant who's going to be my heir." And the Lord reconfirmed to him what His promise to him was. It's not going to be Eliezer. It's going to be a son of your own body who's going to come, a natural born son. So here we are in chapter 16, and I just want to read verse 1 here initially. Here it says, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar." Stop right there. If you're not familiar with the story, you'll see that this is going to lead to some trouble. But there's something that I want to point out about this maid that she's got, this servant that she's got. It struck me today as I was looking at it. It says she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. I was thinking about that. I thought, you know, she's got an Egyptian servant. How in the world did she get an Egyptian servant? And then I thought, well, duh. She got an Egyptian servant when Abram was in Egypt, when he went down into Egypt. Which brings me back to my point that I've talked about before. Was this God's blessing on Abraham that he had all these riches that he acquired while he was in Egypt? You know, when we think about those riches and what they did to him initially, what happened? He got in a fight with his nephew, and he almost lost his nephew due to a war that swept through the land, and because those two had separated, and they separated because of conflict, and the conflict was because of all these riches. And now we're on the precipice of another debacle here, and it has in its mixture this blessing, so-called, from Egypt. To me, it's a residue of something, a residue of an earlier debacle. I know that I am not, well, I'm not with the status quo in a lot of ways to say that I don't think this is necessarily God's blessing, these riches that He had. I know there's a lot of teachers. I got a little newsletter here in case you're interested. This is on Christian wealth. And this will tell you how to amass Abrahamic wealth. This is a book that you can get that has five simple steps that you can take to amass Abrahamic wealth. You must do what Abraham did to obtain the wealth that God promised in the Abrahamic covenant. The Bible proves that God wants to make you wealthy. You will see the precedent for biblical tithing and giving, here we go, offerings above and beyond the tithe that Abraham set. You will see how this tithing and giving made him extremely wealthy. Abraham was probably one of the richest men. These pages of this book, if you'll get it, will dispel the devil's myth that God wants you in poverty, and they show how you can overcome the only two things that stand between you and wealth. There you go. This book contains faith-building nuggets, sumptuously prepared by loving hands, that you haven't seen before. In these five simple steps to Abrahamic wealth, you get the following. You learn how to overcome the two reasons, it really makes me want to find out, but the two reasons why you're not wealthy. You learn how to tap into God's seven Abrahamic blessing power that produce wealth. You learn you learn how God makes inanimate objects supernaturally live to grow a financial harvest for you. Yeah, well, it's from this the Abrahamic seed group. I got to tell you, that last part is creepy to me. That's like something out of a horror movie. When inanimate objects come to life around my house, I get a little wigged out. We're back to the smoking fire pot. This will help. You learn how to get an automatic audience with God for wealth-producing purposes. I guess it's like a fast pass there at Disney World or whatever. You get to go to the front of the line. While all the rest of the losers are waiting there for an audience with God, you get to go right to the front and get your wealth. And I guess Jesus takes your order or something. You learn how to pray the financial blessing prayer to receive your financial blessing. Seven benefits of Bible tithing. Here we go. Seven benefits that apply to Christians today for tithing. You learn, consequently, why Christians should tithe. In other words, get busy. But there's even more. Making an offering tithe is not even the beginning of the financial blessing machine. I guess it's like a magical goodie producer. Anyway, you learn even more financial blessings, and on and on and on. So if you just buy this book, and you can join the Abrahamic Seed Group, and you can get newsletters like this that will... Yeah. But the fact is I realize that there are people who build their entire doctrines around the idea that Abraham was wealthy and that the promise is that we get Abraham's blessings. His inheritance is our inheritance, and that means we're supposed to be wealthy. But I still contest that everything that we see as being the fruit of the wealth that he amassed in Egypt is not good fruit. It's not good. And what we're going to see here is just a continuation of the residue of unbelief that Abram fell into when he went to Egypt the first time. Let's read verse 2 to find out what happens next. So she said, she's got an Egyptian maidservant. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abram agreed to what Sarai said. There's a concert of sin here. I know that I've read many commentaries that try to single out Sarai for the problem here. But it's not just Sarai who's at fault in this. This is a concert effort by everybody involved to really fall into unbelief. The promise that God gave Abram was that he was going to have offspring. He was going to be blessed with this offspring, and he would be the father of a great nation. And Abram was thinking, well, maybe it's going to have to go through Eliezer, my servant. And God said to him, no, it's going to be your own son. A son from your own body is going to do this, a natural-born son. But now, 10 years have gone by. We'll see that in a minute. But 10 years have gone by, and nothing's happened. Nothing's gotten them any closer to the fulfillment of this promise, the fulfillment of the longing of their hearts. And this is a longing for Abram. He wants this. He desires to see this promise fulfilled in his life. And Sarai, her sin stems from, well, her unbelief and from her inability to be patient and trust the Lord at this point. Now, Sarai is a woman, obviously. She's a nurturer, though, by nature. That's just a distinction there between the sexes. I mean, she is a nurturer. She wants to see the fulfillment of this desire for her husband. She wants to have a child of her own, or she wants to have this fulfillment as well. I'm sure that she was feeling the pressure of sensing maybe that she was to blame. She wasn't able to have children, so she sensed the pressure of that this is my fault, that this isn't happening for him. And she begins to feel impatient because of it. out of these things. It's not necessarily that she's, well, obviously she's not. She's called a righteous woman. She's not wicked or anything like that, but she's human. And so she's facing all of these different things that emerge partly from her nature as a nurturer, and she's wanting to see something happen. So she does what so many of us fall into, is she starts taking things into her own hands. She takes matters into her own hands to make it come to pass the way she thinks it should come to pass. And we've already seen how badly this kind of stuff goes already. That's what Abraham did when he went down into Egypt the first time. And now here we see the same thing. Sarai is looking at this and beginning to logically reason it out. Well, it's not happening through me. I'm not having this child. It hasn't happened yet. And so we're going to have to do something here. We got to make something happen. We got to take action, or this isn't going to take place. So she knows the desire of his heart. She's determined the desire of Abram's heart, and so she's looking to solve this for him. She's looking to solve it some other way. I'm sure it was a desire of her own heart to get rid of the stigma of the fact that they didn't yet have a child, and yet here they have this promise that they're going to be the parents of a great nation. So she knows his desire. She wants him to have a son. She herself wants to have a son. I mean, her desire here really is to please Abram, and that's a noble thing, really. I mean, we can't look at Sarai and be judgmental because her desire is to please her husband. She's wanting to fix this for him. It's very noble. There's love implicit in this. There is a huge sacrifice implicit in this. I mean, you know, she's offering her husband to another woman in order to make this happen, in order to bring this child into the world. And that's not an easy concept for a woman to embrace, I'm sure. But she was willing to sacrifice to that degree because of her love for him. But as noble as those intentions may be, and as noble as our intentions may be at any given point, the problem comes down to going in the wrong direction to see her desires fulfilled. She seeks the fulfillment of her desires for Abraham, for her own self, through some other means aside from God. And that ultimately is where she stumbles and goes awry. It's something that we always have to be careful of. She's looking to some other source other than God to bring about the fulfillment of her desires. Now, Abraham's sin in this, or Abram's sin in this, is that, well, it's the same sin that Adam committed way back there in the beginning part of Genesis. Abram's sin is that he's weak. He doesn't recognize his part in this. I mean, he didn't bring his side of the marriage union to this situation. Because the male and the female are distinct, they're different. They each have a different role in life. It's not a matter of equality. It's a matter of roles, of distinction in our makeup and how we blend together and work together to fulfill God's will in our lives, in our families and all. The woman brings one side of it to the equation. She brings the nurturing, loving heart. She brings that care and concern. The man, while he's to be mindful of that and doing that, he's still by nature, he brings that problem solving, that strength to help direct that passion and that love. And he didn't bring his side to it. You know, we realize, I mean, we've got to come to grips with that. We are distinct. We're different, male and female. We're going to be different. I'm not talking about equality in any of this. We're not saying that a woman is less than a man or a man is less than a woman. We're just talking about the distinction. You can see it from the time they're children. We're always going to be different. You can see it in the way a man holds, I was thinking about that. You see it in the difference in the way a man holds a baby from a woman. You watch a man holds a baby like a football. He holds that baby down there and he looks at it, glances at it real quick. Yeah, blanket's on, everything's safe, everything's good. And the rest of the time he's looking out, you know, waiting for the attack or waiting for somebody to come by and hand that baby off to. You watch a woman hold a baby, it's completely different. She's always looking at it. And she's always adjusting the blanket, making sure it's just right. Men don't adjust blankets. His blanket's there. Blanket's good. Blanket fine. Wait for attack. But the woman, she's always making sure. Blanket's in the right place. The hat's well. I'm picking all the little stuff off the baby's face. Men don't pick. They just don't. They don't want anything to do with that. But that's the difference. It's the distinction in this. There's nothing wrong with either one of those. It's the distinction that we have. Abram didn't bring his side to this union. He didn't bring his part that he needed to bring in this situation. He was weak here. It's really the same sin that Adam committed. He was weak in the presence of really a temptation, a weak in the presence of the enemy slipping in to try to thwart what God's plan was. He didn't provide the strength that he needed to bring to help direct the passion that was there. He caved in. So here we have this desire and we have this passion cut loose to go in the wrong direction instead of being stabilized and focused back on God. Well, let's continue reading on here, because it gets worse. So after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Then Sarai said to Abram, "You are responsible for the wrong I'm suffering. I put my servant in your arms. And now that she knows she's pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." "Your servant is in your hands," Abraham said. "Do whatever you think is best." Then Sarai mistreated Hagar, so she fled from her. Sarai's presumption, Abram's passivity, and now Hagar's pride, all working together in this cauldron of misdirected desires that we see here. What was conceived in impatience and misdirected desires now is boiling up here in this contempt and this pride, and it leads to anger and to heartache and to pain. That's the way it always goes. This is the human story again and again and again. We see it in the patriarchs. We see it developing there. And it's a continuation of what happened in the Garden of Eden. And we see in our own lives today, it continues on. This same distinct pattern and result of looking somewhere else other than God to find the fulfillment for our desires, and what it leads to is the same thing: pain and heartache, anger and despair. This, in essence, is Abram's second trip into Egypt. He went there to escape the famine in the first place, and now he's going here to look for the manifestation of the promise that God gave him. But he's still looking to another source for the fulfillment of his desire other than God. And this is the continuing result. You know, this happens to us over and over and over again. We get dissatisfied waiting. We're not good at waiting, especially as Americans, we're not good at it. Waiting is like anathema to us. And it's true. I mean, I'm certainly not indicting the culture, not indicting myself. It's true with me. I mean, I can't tell you how impatient I can get waiting for my fast food in line at a McDonald's or whatever. You know, it's taking me minutes to get these hamburgers, and how can I be bothered with all of this kind of stuff? We hate to wait. We're built that way. Everything about our culture is designed to make everything go faster. Our computers are getting faster and faster. I mean, you know, I'm able to process things now and make things happen, you know, like this, and I'm still getting impatient. I sit there still going, "Man, oh man, what, come on, that hourglass has been there for a nanosecond already. I can't be waiting like this." And that's just the way it is. Our culture has developed this way, and we get dissatisfied with life. We get dissatisfied and get burned out so easily, so quickly in our spiritual lives, because we're looking for something. We're looking for something to fulfill these longings we have. We're looking for something to fulfill our desires. And we start looking all over the place. We start thinking, well, maybe this job over here is what God's going to give me to make me feel better. Or maybe this relationship over here will satisfy my needs. Or maybe if I can just, you know, find the right source of entertainment, I'll be okay and I'll feel good for a while. Or whatever things it may be, but we always end up coming back to the same result that these guys did, because these things just don't satisfy us. Because what we're really looking for is the fulfillment of a promise. What Abram and Sarai were really looking for was the fulfillment of the promise God gave them. And that fulfillment is told to us in Hebrews chapter 11. They were looking for a city whose builder and maker was God. What we're really desiring, more than anything else, whether we've identified it yet in our own lives or not, what we're really, really wanting is to see the restoration of the way things were. We may not have articulated it that way in our minds. We may not fully be able to sit down and give us some eschatological, theological outline of what it is we're expecting. But what we have echoing through our hearts and our spirits is echoes of Eden. We remember instinctively back to what it was before the fall. We know innately, inherently, that things aren't the way they're supposed to be, and we're longing for that restoration. We're longing for the fulfillment of a promise that Jesus is going to return and he's going to establish his kingdom. And there's going to be righteousness and peace and joy for eternity. There's a movie, L.A. Story, done a while back. Danny Glover is in it, and Steve Martin is in it. And at one point, there's a scene in there where Kevin Kline's in it as well. Kevin Kline's car breaks down in a bad neighborhood, and instead of getting help from the people that are around him, a gang comes up and they're getting ready to rob him. And he had called for a tow truck, and Danny Glover's driving the tow truck, and when it finally shows up, these guys start harassing him and, you know, calling him all these names for trying to help out a white guy or whatever. And all of a sudden he stops and he's looking at them and he says, "It's not supposed to be like this. It's not supposed to be this way. I'm supposed to come here and be able to do my job. You guys are supposed to be here helping this guy out. I'm supposed to be able to give him the help that he needs to get him on his way. Something's gone terribly wrong here. It's not supposed to be like this." Expressing what we innately know, it's not supposed to be like this. We look at this world, we see a sniper out there in Washington killing all these people, and immediately we think, it's not supposed to be like this. Innocent children getting killed for no reason than just the pleasure of the man who pulls the trigger. It's not supposed to be like this. We're longing for the fulfillment of a promise that was given from the Ancient of Days. We're longing for the fulfillment of the promise of the seed of the woman who will come and crush the head of that serpent. And that's what we truly need. That's what we're truly looking for in the fulfillment of our desires. But what we do is what Abram and Sarai did. We fall way short. We start looking to the stuff of this earth. We start scrounging around in Egypt to find the fulfillment that we want. We start looking to this world and the temporal solutions to provide some satisfaction, and it never works. Well, Abram falls way short in this story because Sarai's complaining to him and blaming him for this situation. And what is his response? He looks up from his paper for a minute and says, "Whatever you say, dear. Well, do what you think is best." And goes right back into what he was thinking about before. And honestly, you know, you can't blame him too much. I mean, this is a guy caught between two angry women. I mean, I wouldn't want to be there. But at the same time, his calling is not to do what he did here. His calling in life is as a problem solver. His calling in life, as any man's calling in life, is to bring strength to a situation. To bring that strength that could help direct and provide a solution. Insight. Because a man has a battle to fight. No matter how we look at it, but I'll tell you, instinctively, for some reason, and especially the men of this culture, but men, because of the fall, our instinct initially is to run, is to hide, is to do what Abram did here. Hide behind the paper, peek up, say whatever you think, and then go back. Hiding and hoping it'll all go away. I mean, it's endemic of our culture. It's endemic of the men of our culture. We've lost touch with who we are supposed to be. We've lost touch with our meaning and our purpose in life, our calling in life. It's to be strong, is to provide that strength. It's to be strong in the Lord, of course. I don't mean just in intrinsically, but to confront things and to deal with the issues of life in strength and compassion and concern. But by and large, instead, men run and hide. We go off and hide. We hide in our jobs. You know, things don't work right, and there's conflict, and there's trouble, and we say we don't want to deal with it. We hide in our jobs and peek into the home every once in a while and, you know, make sure the bills are paid and then run off and hide some more. Or we come home. If we come home, we hide in the television set and just, you know, pop our heads out of the TV every once in a while, glance around, make sure the place isn't on fire, and go back in. Or we hide in a bottle of alcohol. Or we hide in any number of things, in our favorite sport or something. Or we hide. That's what happens. Wherever. Instead of rising to the challenge of the role that God's given us in life, we find passivity to be so much easier. But the result is dreadful. It was dreadful here. This is a terrible condition for Abram to be in. Take heart, because, you know, Abram, as Kern pointed out last week, he was, you know, God wasn't ashamed to be called his God. God wanted to be called his friend and stuff. He knows our hearts. He remembers our frame. He knows that we're dust. So I'm not trying to set up some ideal, you know, up here and say, boy, God's going to be mad at you until we get there. But it's one of those things. We have to recognize who we are. I'll tell you, there's great fulfillment in that, knowing who we are and what we're called to. So Abram hides, and Sarai then is left to basically vent her frustration and anger against Hagar, and she mistreats her. We don't know, we're not given the details on it, but, you know, Hagar's pregnant, so she's, you know, obviously not real comfortable anyway, and they're in the desert, and so whatever was happening there, you know, she's probably increasing her workload and treating her poorly, treating her badly, and whatever it is, it gets to the point that she goes running off into the desert. She flees away. I mean, she's obviously looking at the potential of death as being better than staying there with Sarai. And what's transpiring there? Well, let's continue reading here. Verses 7 through 9. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. He said to Hagar, and he said, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from, and where are you going? I'm running away from my mistress Sarai, she answered. Then the angel of the Lord told her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. The angel added, I will so increase your... Oh, I'm sorry, I wanted to stop here before that, before 10. So here we have the angel of the Lord meeting Sarai out in the desert. Whenever we come across the angel of the Lord in scriptures, especially in the Old Testament, by and large, we are talking about the pre-incarnate Christ. Pre-incarnate Christ means that Jesus appeared in a human form, albeit we believe a phantasmic form, not incarnate as he became in the advent of Christ on the earth, where he took on flesh. But it's a pre-incarnate Christ. It's God, the Son of God, appearing to mankind in the form of a man. And the reason we assume this is because he receives worship many times. He's adored as God, and he gives commands in the first person as God. And so what we're seeing here, we believe, is the pre-incarnate Christ appearing to Hagar and speaking to her. She's running away. And it's an interesting thing here, because here's Hagar in her pride. You know, she was sinning in this as well. She felt contempt for Sarai, instead of, you know, wanting to be part of the solution or whatever, she allowed her position in life suddenly, which clearly increased in her position there, bearing the son of Abram, allowed herself to indulge in this sense of superiority and lord that over Sarai, which she had no business doing. And so she's running away from her situation. It got bad for her as the result of that sin of pride. It got bad. And she's running off, and it's an interesting thing to me, because you know what? We can run from the circumstances that we face. We can run away as much as we want, but what does the Lord say to her when he meets her? What does he address her as? He says, Hagar, servant of Sarai. We can run away from our circumstances as much as we want to, but we cannot run away from the calling and the purpose that God has placed before us. Jonah learned that lesson. Jonah was called to go to Nineveh. And instead, he ran off to Joppa. And he jumped on a ship, and the Lord wasn't going to allow him to do that. He could run away from the circumstances that he was in, but he couldn't run away from what God had called him to do, or the calling or the purpose that he had in life. We do this all the time. I don't even need to really expound on that. We can draw the conclusions that we see from that, the analogies that we see from that, so easily. How quick we are to try to abandon something when it gets difficult. How quick we are to run instead of facing up to it and allowing the Lord to do what he's going to do through us in whatever circumstances we're facing. We can run from the circumstances, but we can't run from what God's called us to, which means, like Israel had to do, go around the mountain several times, we more than often will go right back around and face those same circumstances. Running rarely ever, rarely if ever. Well, it doesn't. Running doesn't help. And I think it's cool to see the tenderness that God shows her here. You know, she's not the vehicle of the promise. She is not the one through whom the promised child is going to come. God knows this. And in fact, really what they've been involved in here is something that is diametrically opposed to what his plan and purpose was. Yet look at the tenderness with which he deals with her. He's got compassion here. God's nature is to be compassionate and loving to the outcast. You know, the when we run around as Christians talking to the lost and giving them the turn or burn mentality, there's a theological truth behind the idea of turning or burning, but yet you don't see Jesus representing that heart or that attitude. You don't see the early church representing that kind of an attitude. God's nature, God's heart is tender and compassionate for the lost and for the outcast. I'm totally not down with the whole idea of antagonizing the lost or criticizing those who are outside of Christ. We need to show that compassion that God has. Let's keep reading verses 10 to 12. The angel added, "I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count." The angel of the Lord said to her, "You are now with child, and you will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael," which means "the Lord hears," "for the Lord has heard your misery. He shall be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him, and he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." It's an interesting thing. Kidner's commentary says that this is actually a parody of the promise made to Abram. If you look at it, it contains the promises that are actually made to Abram in this. A descendants too numerous to number. But instead of being a blessing to all the earth, he's actually a wild donkey of a man who ends up antagonizing everybody and being a problem. What's very interesting about this is that Ishmael has 12 sons, and those 12 sons become the formation of many of the Arabic states and Arabic nations. And what we have here is the very origin. If you look at Israel today and you look at the problems in the Middle East, come right back to this passage right here, because God explained what it was going to be. There is going to be hostility between the Arabs and the Jews, and it goes back to this point. And it's continued all through history, and it continues to this very day. It's as recent as the day's headlines. We see how this has played out. And it is a result of Sarai's impatience and Abram's passivity and Hagar's pride. It's a result of trying to take charge and be God and not allow God to fulfill his plan in his timing and his way. And the sorrow of it reaches to this very day. What a heavy, heavy concept that is. Let's finish this off, verse 13 to 16. She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God who sees me." For she said, "I have now seen the one who sees me." That is why the well is called Beer Lai Roy or whatever. When you see that beer there, it doesn't mean it was like the spring was not like a tap on a keg or something. That's just the words that they used in there. And it's still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son that she had born. So obviously he believed what she had heard from the Lord out there. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. Yeah, these guys are calling that a blessing, and that is astounding to me, because I don't want children when I'm 86. I'm just going on record right now to tell you that. Verse 13 really gives us the meat of this whole passage. The first six verses, it's interesting to me that God isn't even mentioned in the first six verses except to blame him for Sarai's barrenness. But there's no record of them consulting with God or asking God about the fulfillment of his promise or reminding the Lord of what he'd promised or whatever. No, it's just a scramble of human effort trying to make something happen here in their impatience and their something outside of God's counsel. Stuart Briscoe said, "To err is human, to make matters worse is a human specialty." And that's definitely what we see developing here through this story. But through it all, what we recognize, it comes through here in verse 13, through it all, God sees. God sees it all. It doesn't matter that Sarai and Abram and Hagar are scrambling around trying to get their own thing going, trying to make something happen. They could be planning or plotting in secret, hidden in the inner chamber of the tent. God sees. God sees it all. He sees everything that we do. He sees everything about us. He knows everything about us. He knows every working inner part of our hearts and our desires. He sees it all. He sees it. He knows. And yet, even seeing it and knowing it, we recognize how he dealt with Hagar. It was compassion and love. Look at the patience that God displays with Abram and Sarai. He doesn't send an angel in with a big fly swatter and have them smacked around a little bit for their impatience. He doesn't do anything of the sort. He sees and he lets it unfold. He's compassionate. He's merciful. He's got a plan he's going to bring to pass. He sees. And I really think that we need to get to that point in life where we say, like Hagar, I have seen the one who sees me. You know, Hagar was not going through a mountaintop experience at this point. We always talk about, you know, yeah, I wish I could stay in those mountaintop experiences where I feel like the Lord is so close and I know He's right there and this and that and the other. You know, Hagar was not going through that. Hagar was out in the desert. Hagar was pregnant and thirsty and lost, out in the middle of the dry and barren wilderness. And she saw the one who sees her. She'd never run too far out in the distance where God wasn't cognizant of where she is. He always knew where she was. And at one point, she is allowed the revelation that she is able to see the one who sees her. I really believe that's what the Lord wants in our lives, in our hearts. We need to learn to see the one who sees us. And regardless of the circumstances that we face, regardless of how dry and deserty our life seems, regardless of the wilderness of the emotions and the longings that we have and the desires we have, we need to be able to see the one who sees us. We need to start seeing him in the details of life, seeing his hand at work, seeing him move, recognizing that he's there and he's working and he's living and he's loving us in the process. You know, when we don't expect him, when we don't expect to see him, when we're busy scrambling around getting our own thing going, we're not going to see him. When we don't expect to see him, we're not going to see him. When we don't expect him to move, we're not going to recognize it when he does. But if we allow this to challenge our hearts to be cognizant of the fact that he sees us, remember that. He sees us. He knows exactly what we're going through. He knows exactly what's going on in our hearts. We need to see the one who sees us. We need to see him in the details and recognize his hand at work and acknowledge his love for us and find our contentment in that and be satisfied in the knowledge that he sees and he cares and he knows. We need to learn not to be presumptuous. We need to be faithful and patient. And we need to trust our desires to him for their fulfillment and not go racing off trying to be God ourselves. Does that make sense? Right on. Very cool.